Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm your host, Cynthia Poor. And today we have Howie Hawkins, the 2014 New York State gubernatorial candidate, the Green Party candidate. And also in the interview is Dan Platt, who ran for the Albany County executives in 2015, and they were both at the National Convention in Texas last month, and they had to talk about it. So let's start off with you, Howie. What was your overall impression?
Well, I think we got the strongest ticket we've had since Ralph Nader ran in 2000. That's shown in the polls. And what really picked up the last few weeks is all the Bernie Sanders supporters who have come to us. When we were out in the streets, a lot of us went to Philadelphia, and there was a lot of pro-Bernie demonstrators, you know, the Bernie or bus crowd, and they were coming to us really strong. The chant there was Jill, not Hill. And then about 100 of them just decided in Philadelphia they were coming down to Houston. So they joined us at our convention, and we had some prominent surrogates for Bernie Sanders have joined the campaign and spoke there, like Cornel West and Yane Indigo.
Dan, what was your impression?
It was robust. It kind of did what conventions are supposed to do. It's part an actual party. Second, networking, place to network, meet new people. I did all that. Share ideas with others. And generally build the party internally, which is kind of counter to a media narrative that the convention is supposed to be one big ad. And so we're kind of, there was a bit of tension between that. And I don't mean to do a disservice to the great things that did happen at the convention. There was a lot of great, interesting things that happened. I actually talked to some Bernie busters myself towards the end of things. And they told me how they came with one set of concerns, mostly about Stein and Baraka, but left with a different set of concerns that mostly had to do with the fact that the Greens are a young party, that we've been historically or until now or until soon in the future really small and a dedicated set of activists with their own priorities, and that as we grow going forward, we're going to change, and Howie definitely has his vision of how to make ourselves stronger, and I have my own ideas as well. But it was really a lot of great conversation, and it was something that needs to happen all over the place.
Yeah, Howie, when you talk to people and you voice your support for Jill Stein, people look at you and say, if you're going to support Jill Stein, you're ensuring Donald Trump's election or win. What do you say to that?
I think Donald Trump is destroying himself. He's insulting just about everybody in the country, and he's acting like Ronald McDonald, I mean, with the crazy hair and the stupid hat and the things. It's very hard to take him seriously, and more people, including, you know, the Republican establishment, you know, senators, members of Congress, endorsing Clinton. So she's far away the front runner. And a vote for Clinton is, from our point of view, is a vote against the Greens having ballot lines going forward. 37 states are up for ballot qualification. And so if you're voting for Clinton to stop Trump, you're also voting to stop the Green Party as an alternative on the left. And a lot of people say, oh, it's only the privileged that can afford to vote for the Greens. I say, no, only the privileged can afford to vote for the status quo, which is what Clinton represents. And she's not going to change anything as far as working class people who have been downwardly mobile now for four decades. She's been in the middle of the transition of the Democratic Party from the New Deal Democrats, who were liberal and tried to help working people, to the plain old corporate New Democrats, who the only thing they know to do is to help the big businesses. and mm-hmm. and pass trade deals that pit workers against each other across national borders and drive our wages down and all the things that have happened over the last four decades. That's what she represents. So I don't think anybody but the privileged can afford to vote for her.
Now, one big issue, and it's not being addressed by Trump or Clinton, it was not addressed by Bernie Sanders, is the student loan debt crisis. Jill talks about it, but she has been getting a media blackout. So all these people in the media that make decent money, who live great lives, they're complicit in this. What you say that's true? Dan, what do you think?
Yeah, certainly. One example is the fact that you could even say it's a pattern that whenever the heat could ever be on Clinton, Trump then ratchets up his ridiculousness. But for the most, let's see, there's also the... Oh, yeah, so we were talking student loans. So, yeah, we mentioned it a few times in the convention. It was certainly there. And, yes, the media doesn't want to cover that. When they, when it is in the media who are friendly or sympathetic, they're covering us like they covered Occupy Wall Street with a lot of scorn, condescension. They don't like seeing other people have fun, having engaging conversations. They just want something scripted, almost. They want us mm-hmm. to play by beltway rules. And otherwise, they're just there to write about how silly and out of touch we are, when, in fact, we're probably more in touch with the normal weirdness of everyday Americans than they can ever grasp. There's also a point about how a vote for Clinton is a vote for corporate control of our government. And that is, if you use the textbook definition, what fascism is. So to say that, you know, and so and one point of many Clinton defenders is that how can you ever compare the two? Well, in terms of corporate control of our government, perhaps one is better than the other, but and that would be Hillary. But otherwise, it's still a vote for corporate control of our government, and that's top-down, and that's bosses in charge and inequality, not only in money, but in power, in rights, and everything else.
You know, I follow the news, and you, both of you are involved in the Green Party. From your observations of Americans, how many people are totally unaware of Jill Stein? Howie?
The polling I've seen is about 80%. Don't know. But I think that's going to change. You know, when I watch MSNBC or CNN or Fox, she's getting mentioned, you know, and when they do polls, when they talk about third parties, it's pretty frequent. So I think a lot more people are being exposed to the fact that they've got other options. So I think that mm-hmm. can only help us going forward.
Sam?
Yeah, the media acts like an arbiter of fairness and neutrality. And, you know, it's called the fairness, not the fairness doctrine, the view from nowhere. And it truly is. Their heads are not nowhere. But they act like they're not, in fact, the tastemakers of American opinion. The more they talk mm-hmm. about this as a four-way race, the more it will be a four-way race. The more they talk about it as a two-way race, Trump or Clinton, the more people become hopeless and despondent about their lack of choices and how it's just Trump, Clinton, how terrible, just end it all, vote for Cthulhu. Mm-hmm. If it's a four-way race, or even better, if we actually replace the Democratic and Republican parties with the Greens and Libertarians, and we talk about that as if it was a two-way race, because certainly in millennials, my age group, that's more like, you know, that's sometimes the case, that would be a different story. And that's a story that is mm-hmm. developing, because I think as we kind of, as I noticed in mid-January or before the DNC, the two-horse race of Trump and Hillary was starting to get boring, and perhaps more and more people were tuning out. So to keep ratings up, to keep profits at a certain level, because they are corporate media, and that's why I mentioned corporate power, they are, in fact, part of the same system. That's why we need independent media. That's why we need independent parties, independent gardens, independent businesses. You kind of have to do it. You do it yourself, and that's how you have your own power. And that's a tangent, but otherwise that's where I'm going.
Now, Howie, last night I was watching Lawrence O'Donnell, and Lawrence O'Donnell was criticizing Donald Trump, as usual. So all the people on MSNBC criticized Trump, and all the people on Fox criticized Clinton. From your observations, how much of what is reported to us is scripted and is not really new?
Well, we know Fox is scripted, at least when Roger Ailes was there. We have lots of reporting saying that, you know, he would meet and decide on the theme like it was a political campaign. What's the message of the day? And everybody had to repeat it. Now that he's out, I expect they probably still have the same pattern with new management, you know, setting that tone. MSNBC, I don't know if they have as tight a messaging discipline, but certainly you listen to Chris Hayes or Rachel Maddow or Lawrence O'Donnell in the evening, and they all are pro-Democratic Party. It's very clear. You know, Morning Joe is, you know, Joe's a Republican and Mika's a Democrat, but they're very establishment. And, you know, they're so horrified at Donald Trump's ignorance on so many things that they tend to, you know, get behind Clinton de facto. Although they will criticize Clinton, you know, they really got her on the emails and the pay-to-play with the Clinton Foundation and that sort of thing. But, you know, the bias of the corporate media, the elite media out of New York City, is to the establishment. They are part of it. So, you know, they were all surprised, or most of them, when Donald Trump got so much support. And, you know, the reality there is the middle-class and working-class Republican voters are upset with their own elite. That wants to cut their Social Security and cut taxes on the rich. And, you know, the average people are saying that doesn't do anything for us. So the Trump rebellion is not that surprising. But they totally missed it because they're not in touch with everyday people. They're, you know, circulating in those elite circles. So I think, you know, the biggest bias is not the bias that they script, whether it's Roger Ailes or just the, you know, pro-Democratic bias of the evening commentators at MSNBC. It's that they move in the elite circles, and they're out of touch with the concerns of regular working people.
When you watch MSNBC or you watch Fox, no, I'm sorry, yeah, when you watch either one of them, you know, Fox criticizes Clinton and MSNBC criticizes Trump. They say the same thing over and over again. They talk about Trump not being qualified, Trump this, Trump that, blah, blah, blah. Why is it, from either your point of view or Dan's point of view, why is it that they are so averse to talk about an alternative to the two-party system? Is it off script? Are they afraid? What's going on? Howie?
I think they're averse because they hang out with the elites and the two-party system, the political cartel, you know, two parties representing the corporate elite. That is their universe, and it's inconceivable to them that that could change. So to the extent they mention third-party challenges like the Greens, it's an aside. And I just think that's their, you know, their mental bias, the frame in which they approach politics. I think that's why they have that point of view.
Dan?
And then it filters down to the general population, and then I see Facebook posts about stating, as a matter of fact, Jill has zero chance in winning. as if they have degrees in statistics or something. But I also want to point out that what we're describing is also a microcosm, or at least Albany is a microcosm of all that as well. And I am not divorced from things on the ground, listening about the palace to our roads breaking down. I mean, and we also, in the arguments about splitting votes, spoiling votes, and who votes belong to, it's a culture of scarcity. Culture of scarcity we've had since the 70s. And what independent parties like the Greens, even libertarians at times, but generally any kind of person outside the Beltway, is fighting for a culture of abundance, fighting for more because we can do it, because we can do the work. The Greens do have growing to do, not only in terms of membership, but in terms of maturing as an organization, having an organization that can handle more diverse, but also more even mainstream viewpoints. And that means, oh, that's right, it'll take a lot of work, but simply put, more hands make lighter work. So there's definitely a call, and the Bernie or Busters are definitely going to help us with this, as I kind of watched them during the convention. And also, some of the ideas we shared about monetary reform, there's a lot in common with other groups that don't follow all of our politics, but would definitely be interested. And it's that kind of coalition building that creates the real viable third-party challenge that I think some in my scene of sorts are making a comparison to the Republican Party, that Abraham Lincoln was a third-party candidate. Now, even as a history nerd, I'm not sure how accurate that is, but certainly in the 1850s you had a lot of abolitionist parties that, I'm sure if you asked in 1850, they had zero chance in winning. But lo and behold, a decade later, you had someone with at least sympathies to those movements as part of that kind of ticket. And the vote was split three ways, so to speak. And you had, it led to a deep political crisis. But we are in a crisis now. The convention is practically not unenforced. When it is enforced, it's done in a slapdash way. And our economics are in a bad state. And pretty much no one should trust and is losing trust in the institutions, whether it be the media, that's what we're talking about, whether it be our money, well, not so much money itself, but simply how things work and how things work don't work, or at least do not help everyone as they should, or at least as everyone feels that they should. And so there's also a matter, the importance of feeling. That corporate media, corporate politics, despite kind of the sappiness of the DNC and their speeches and the kind of coverage of it, there's actually a lack of feeling. You know, if you have a feeling that's outside of a certain script or range, you're labeled a kook, an outsider, and worth ignoring as if you weren't a citizen. Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that Jill Stein can't win and that's why the media won't cover her, I think exhibits a very poor understanding of how politics works. I mean, we had a long tradition in this country of third parties from the 1840s, the Liberty Party for abolition, right through the populist parties in the late 19th century, the Socialist Party in the early 20th century, putting demands before the two parties that were popular with the people, but the two parties were ignoring. And that led to changes like the abolition of slavery, like old age pensions in the form of Social Security. Those kinds of, that's the traditional role of third parties. That's the role that the Green Party can play in this election, bringing forward demands, a lot of them that were raised by Bernie Sanders. He did not win the Democratic primary, but he changed what's at least on paper in the Democratic platform. So for the media to say she can't win, we shouldn't cover her, is to totally miss the story. And then besides, we are going to win a lot of things besides the office of president. I mentioned 37 ballot lines up for qualification in this election. There's also public funding in the 2020 general presidential election. If we get 5%, we qualify for $10 million. If we get more than that, we get a proportionate increase in that public funding. So that's at stake for the Green Party. And then as we go out and campaign for Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka, we are talking to voters, we're collecting lists of supporters, and we're going to take those lists and use them to fight TPP after the election in the lame duck session of Congress and go into next year's local elections here in New York with a list of supporters that we'll keep building upon. So we are building an alternative political movement. And all these things are happening, and we don't have to win the presidency for them to happen. And that's where the media is missing the story. They're missing what's happening at the grassroots. As Dan said, the two-party system is decomposing. You've got a big split in the Democrats between the progressive populists or democratic socialists behind Sanders and the corporate Democrats behind Clinton. And on the Republican side, the popular base, you know, went for Trump as a protest vote, and the old establishment is isolated without a base. So, you know, the two-party system may be decomposing and opening up a space for the Green Party to really surge ahead.
The two-party system, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, for those who are aware, people have heard Jill Stein's name. How many congressional candidates are there? In other words, if something happened and Jill Stein won the presidency, she will not have a Congress to back her up, will she?
Well, Howard? Bernie Sanders had a good answer to that, and it was, we've got to have social movements pressuring whoever's elected, whether it's Clinton, Trump, or Stein. Reforms, if it's Clinton or Trump, we keep pushing the demands we want, like improve Medicare for all, a single-payer system. And if it's Stein and she tries to implement it, she needs the backing of social movements so that members of Congress get the message that their constituents want these reforms. And if they don't support them, they'll be out the next election. So you don't have to be in office to exercise power if you're mobilized and keeping the pressure on the politicians. And that's another thing our campaign is building, because the list of supporters, we can use them to organize in social movements.
I'm glad
on the flip
you
side of
that,
Sylvia.
Go ahead, Dan. Go ahead.
On the flip side of that, there's an organization that was tabling at the convention, and I think they are also doing their own campaign blitz of sorts. It's called Flip the Congress or something like that, and their kind of goal is to flip or change 100 seats. I think that's how many are up for re-election this year, but obviously there will be a lot more in 2 years in the midterms. And there's a handful of Green candidates we have for Congress now, and that includes Matt Fuccello. And the thing about that is just winning one of such seats gives us a national prominence. And we don't have to caucus with the Dems even to use that platform. In fact, it makes it even stronger. Just as an independent senator from Vermont could be on national shows and have somewhat of a name recognition, at least in liberal and progressive circles, and that already gave him kind of a base to work from. I mean, it was an in. And justly, if a Green or two is in Congress or in larger in state government, then more people will know that this party exists. And they'll be able, and those those elected of Green will be putting out statements in a much more timely and in a fashion that would be covered by local press more often than just a campaign once in a while. Because that is the advantage of having a party and not just a single person campaign. This isn't just Jill, you know, Stein for president, even though the Stein campaign is very well organized at this moment. It is about building the party. And that means having many campaigns, it's many people, and it's over the long run. And that is the kind of movement that is most needed.
Howie, what percentage of the electorate did you say Jill Stein has? 8?
Well, I looked at Real Clear Politics, which keeps a list of all the polls. And in the last few weeks, she's between 4% and 7%. Among all voters. But in certain demographics, she's doing very well. Millennials, she's at 14%. She's second among black voters after Clinton. Trump is fourth among black voters. I mean, this guy is just so alienated people of color that, you know, he's hopeless as a candidate.
Okay,
starting at 18% in Florida.
Okay.
That was a
quintomatic poll. Right. Between 14 and 18% of millennials are supporting Stein, with 43 million Americans that are faced with student loan debt. People should be flocking to Jill to support her, to help her, to understand this is my issue, but yet that's not happening. Why is that, Howie?
Well, I think most of those people with student debt don't know what Jill Stein's program to deal with it is. You mentioned earlier that it was ignored. Actually, Clinton and Sanders talked about reducing the payments, the interest payments that students make, so relieving their debt burden a little bit. Jill Stein wants to cancel the debt by having the Fed buy up the remaining loans that are not already owned by the government. The government owns 80% of those loans. The government can simply cancel those loans, and that's what Jill Stein wants to do.
And that's the kind of loan plan, by the way.
Why isn't it resonating? Because people are unaware that she's bringing this subject up?
I think it resonates with those who hear about it. I mean, I've witnessed, her speaking to crowds and young people with student debt. You know, you see a couple of students or young people sitting next to each other, and they look at each other when she says that, and they're like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those who hear it are excited by it. The problem is getting the word out.
Right. 43 million Americans can, change any election, especially this one. Now, in the final moment, I'll start with you, Dan. You've been to Texas. You've run for office. What do you see as the future of the Green Party?
That's a difficult question because the future is so hard to predict, and those that usually do end up looking foolish. I mean, just look at all the pundits who would say Trump had no chance of winning the nomination for the Republicans. No chance, no chance at all. And when you know it, protest votes gave him the nomination. And the same can happen again to a lesser extent. There's still a lot of fear, and so the Greens are working against that. We're working against a corporate controlled economy, media, and so on. But so has every other movement who's made a difference in not just American history, but I would argue world history. And this is something I've put a lot of time into understanding. We're making history every day. Even when it seems we fail or we screw up or we don't have the right optics, as some say to me, or we don't look like we're doing so good, it's all just emotions. We're on our way to big victories, growth, learning, all that good stuff. And it'll lead to success. It has to, because otherwise, the alternative is extremely difficult to contemplate. And something it's a truth not a lot of people want to handle, but things are getting worse, and they're not getting better. We're in the middle of a mass extinction event. The climate, we have a very simple way of explaining how climate change is affecting us here in New York. We used to have four seasons. Now we have two. And when we talk about local issues like collapsing streets and corrupt sell-offs and conflicts of interest between our mayor and the Palace Theater, these are interconnected problems, and they must be solved with an interconnected solution. That doesn't mean one reform or whatever. It takes a network, a system, an ecosystem of independent actors, organizations, and movements. And the Green Party is part of that. It's one of them. It has to be. Because other, everything else, other parties, other organizations, they're not independent enough. They take money from from rich donors, or from corporate partners. They work with those in charge, and they're comfortable with them, and they'll argue about it, and they'll spread their lies, and they will speak to the fear of the other, and that includes others like Trump and his supporters. But they are as hurting, and they are as much as pained as we are. And that pain we feel is the death of our current system.
Howie, what do you see as the future of the Green Party?
I think our future is building from below, building, electing. We have hundreds of local candidates elected around the country. We need to get to tens of thousands, you know, municipal office, county office, and we get more of those, and then those people can be credible candidates for state legislature and U.S. House. And then we start filling the legislatures and the House with credible representatives of the Green Party, and then races for U.S. Senate and the presidency become, you know, something that everybody will take seriously as credible campaigns. That's the future of the Green Party. We're going to build this thing from below and spread the grassroots organization and elected officials and create a foundation for challenging power at every level. And I think one of the things that will enable us to do that is the fact that most districts for legislative office are one-party districts. The Democrats and Republicans get together and they gerrymander safe seats for each other. And so the major party that's the minority in these districts doesn't compete. Sometimes they don't run anybody, or they run token campaigns. That's where the Green Party, even when they're not strong enough to win, can become the second party, the opposition party, the party that brings the issues that are being neglected to the fore. And I think we can replicate that all across the country. So that's the future of the Green Party. We're going to build a movement from below. The presidential race helps lay the basis for that, for example, by winning more ballot lines that people can use in local races going forward.
Like in Georgia, South Carolina.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you, Howie. You've been listening to Howie Hawkins, who was the 2014 New York State gubernatorial candidate on the Green Party line, and Dan Splatt, who ran for Albany County Executive in 2005. If you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes, and hashtag focus on Albany if you have a question or a comment about this show. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking the time to talk about the Green Party, and thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a great day.